For our guests, we'll let you know that we are in the midst of a series on the enduring truth, and it's really the history leading up to the New Testament church. And by way of introduction, I'll just ask ourselves again, because it's important perhaps to help till the ground a little bit, to make our minds a little more ready to receive what we're about to receive, is why study history? Why does it even matter? Well, by studying history, it helps us to understand where we are and why we are here, and it helps us to better understand our thought processes and our patterns of behavior and the patterns that we see in society, and it helps us to understand them in a much broader context. We can be focused, and one term for this is become myopic, on our own little world and our own little thought processes and what's going on in our lives. And what history does in studying it can open us up and help us to really understand and see where we are and what events are occurring around us and how they fit into a much bigger picture. I have here a book entitled The Time Chart of the History of the World. And if we were to fold this out, it's 28 feet long. And so it would go from here over to Tom. And it shows the chart from Adam and Eve all the way up to recent times. And it's really helpful to think about where we are and that we're on this time continuum. Of course, God is eternal and goes all the way back and all the way forward, and I think time is a construct that helps us to keep track of things, but we'll learn more about that at some point. But this time chart of the history of the world can be very helpful with regard to understanding what we read and what we learn and where it fits. Now, it occurred to me at one point when we were at Cincinnati and observed an ABC class, and after talking with ABC students, that the way that the classes are taught, they're not always in sequential order. You don't go to ABC and in a year you're being blasted with this fire hose of knowledge, but if that's not challenging enough, it's even more challenging that you have these classes that are in segments. Like the Gospels may happen first, and you may also be reading about the prophets or studying the prophets, and then Ezekiel and Daniel and Acts, and they're in a mixed order. So how do we as humans keep track of all of this? Well, it's helpful to just think about where it fits on the timeline. And at ABC, you receive in a year the amount of biblical knowledge that you would probably receive in about 40 years here in the congregation. And yet, it's very similar in that we have different messages from different time periods. And if we think about these different messages and when we receive them, if we don't see it as part of a much bigger picture or part of a much bigger context, then we see it for what it might be, which is a beautiful piece of a puzzle. And over the years, we collect all these different pieces of the puzzle. And what we're trying to do with this series is help to show what the outline looks like and what the bigger picture looks like. And then as we get these disparate pieces, we start to know where they fit in the picture and where they fit in the master puzzle. Since that book is a little large and cumbersome and hard to put in your briefcase or pocket or tuck into your Bible, there's actually a really nice tool that many of you probably have from Mr. Dan Dowd. Do you remember a year or two ago Dan Dowd came out? And he's a publisher, and he has put the Old Testament history on one side of this chart and the New Testament history on the other. How many of you have a copy of this? Okay, most. I'll tell you that if you want a copy, let me know, and I will ask Mr. Dowd if we can get some more. This does fit neatly in your Bible, and it often blows right off the podium, but not this podium because we have edges here. Another amazing design quality of this new podium. But this is great to keep in your Bible, and you can, when you're studying something or listening to a sermon, you can go and find where it fits. And as we're talking about these different empires, and we're talking about the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Persians and the Greeks and then the Romans, you can say, well, where did those time periods fit? And what was going on in Daniel's world, if we're studying Daniel, for instance, or some of the prophets? Who, we know who the king is that they may be talking to. We may know what's going on in Jerusalem or in Israel, but what's going on in the broader context, and how does that affect what we're learning? So I'm hoping that all of this is helpful toward that end. That's what we're trying to accomplish. And where we are now in the history, if you remember, we've gone through those different timelines. We went back to Solomon's time, so we pick up the timeline of the Hebrew people, and we remember that there was a major split after Solomon's death, and Jeroboam and Rehoboam each had control over different parts of the kingdom. So the 10 tribes of Israel were under Jeroboam's control, and then Rehoboam retained Jerusalem with the tribes of Judah and Benjamin. Judah being the larger, more prominent, so that's why they are referred to today as the Jews. And ultimately, the Assyrian captivity came in, and the Israelites were eventually deported and scattered. That's going to become very important here, not in today's message necessarily, but in the next message, we'll start to see the importance of that scattering of the people and how that plays in. So we're at the point now where we're going to take a look at the Greeks and see what's going on in the Greek Empire. The Greeks were really, it started to have a significant influence. And I say influence more than control, and we'll see why. From 1200 BC to 323 BC. 323 very specifically, because that was the death of Alexander the Great. And throughout their history, in the 7th and 6th centuries BC, we started to see a real transformation. A transformation in the thought processes of people. And perhaps this was one of the greatest transformations in human history. And it helps explain much as to why religion is practiced as it is today. So ancient Greek civilization, ancient Greek ended about 1200 BC, then was a period of political, philosophical, artistic, and scientific achievements that formed a legacy with unparalleled influence on Western civilization. Now, what was happening here? Why were they able to advance so much during this time period? Does anybody have any ideas? Yes, we'll get to that, the infrastructure. So you're talking about, infrastructure and ability to travel, and you're on it. By the way, these are my sources. I throw this slide up there. I'll pause for a moment and give a nod to the sources because it's important to understand where this comes from. Of course, the Bible. Western civilization, the textbooks. We still have the textbook from, I still have mine from college. It hasn't changed much. Our kids in high school had, when they were kids, they're young adults now, but they had their Western Civ book, and it was always a good refresher. So certainly the history of Western civilization. An ABC course by Gary Petty on early church history is accessible to you. If you go to abc.ucg.org, you will be on the ABC page. You can hit courses, and you can take this class. You can take any of the classes that they have recordings for, which is probably about 75% or so. And some of them are in different years, but most of them, interestingly enough, were taken during the time when many of our students were there. So you'll hear what our own congregation, members of our own congregation, heard. So that's a great class to take. The Faith Once Delivered is also, it was a lecture, not a full class, but a lecture that Darris McNeely gave, how doctrine was changed in the early church. So we will be accessing much of that content in the next few sessions. Understanding the Gospels class is a class taught by Scott Ashley. He We used to call it Survey of the Gospels in college, and it's basically a survey of the four Gospels. He is now teaching a class on Tuesday nights for the ministry, and so we're able to join him Tuesday nights with ministers around the world. Clive Dumont is in South Africa, and it's 2 a.m. his time, and he's up for that class, and I can understand why. It's worth it. And so we are really enjoying that, and so material comes in from that, online articles, and Plato's Shadow is a book here that was written by Gary Petty, who has a fascination with history, has studied it, speaks on it often, gave that class on it, and the class, Early Church History, is an outline of this book. So this book is really a compilation of his notes from that class. And so this book here is called Primitive Christianity in Crisis, and it's written by Alan Knight. He was a Worldwide Church of God member at one point, and he wrote this book because he's talking about first century Christianity, which is also referred to by him as primitive Christianity, and that primitive Christianity, or in other words, the Christianity that Christ taught, that the early disciples believed, is in crisis. And we're seeing why. That's much of what was the inspiration behind this series of messages, is that we come to understand why it's being threatened and where these ideas come from. So hopefully it's all starting to come together. So, Martha, you're right that the infrastructure started to come together during this time period. So we're back to the question, why were the Greeks able to advance so much during this several hundred year period? Why was it such a metamorphosis with regard to thought? And perhaps it's because civilization was becoming far more sophisticated. Specializations of duties were occurring, so that it wasn't that every individual had their own farm and worked every day to produce fruit of the ground to eat. It had at this point gone beyond that, where there were now more massive farms. Religion was transforming from a very transactional type religion, where gods were given sacrifices and submitted to in order to receive the blessing of rain in due season and sunshine and all the things needed to just sustain. Because at one point there was no storage. There was no freezers. There was no way to carry large amounts of grain if you were nomadic. You needed every year, again, all the blessings that came from God to just sustain. And we saw how fast society changed back in Genesis when there were 7 years of famine and 7 years of plenty. God orchestrated that, and he put Egypt into power as a result of it because he gave Joseph insight into what was happening. And we, again, these playbooks and these patterns could start to recur. That's a whole nother message there. So start to think about that at some point. But does anybody remember this? This is a little psychological model, or a model by Maslow. And Maslow started to think about how we as humans behave and where we operate. And perhaps this helps explain why the Greeks were able to accomplish so much during this time frame, because at the base of the pyramid, in other words, our most basic human needs are physiological. We need food. We need a place to sleep. We have to be asleep. We need water to drink. It's been said that every civilization is 9 meals from anarchy. That would include ours. Imagine, we know what it's like after one day of not eating. Imagine 2 days goes by, and 3 days, and now it just doesn't matter anymore. We've even seen disruption in our country in the last year, just because it seemed like rules were off, but looting and the types of behavior that can occur for emotional reasons, imagine when they are physiological. Imagine when you haven't eaten or haven't had something to drink in days. Then if Walmart has it, if power's out and the internet doesn't work and you can't get your credit card to swipe, it's possible that people will just go in and take some water or food, right? So even our own society seems so civilized and structured, yet 9 meals later it can devolve into anarchy. And that's because we've dropped to the base of the pyramid. Maslow's saying this is the foundational elements. If we have this, we can go to the next phase, but if we don't, then we revert back. And so then we get to safety and a certain structure, which is, I think, what Martha was referring to. They were able to travel and communicate in different ways, and we're going to go into that in more detail. But having some feeling of safety. So it's one thing to be well-fed and also always under threat from others coming to take what you have. And if we read about early days biblically, or we go back to different times of civilization, we know that there was always this threat. So around 1000 AD even, this was still going on. The Danes and the Vikings were coming to the British Isles and just taking what they had and trying to establish these physiological needs. So they had walled cities and attempts to protect themselves and have safety. We know that Jerusalem was a walled city, so that was very much part of it. We read about all these different empires that came in successive waves to take that over. Love and belonging and esteem and self-actualization are higher functions on the pyramid. So what we see is that these base of the pyramid functions were all addressed, and so society was able to start to think in a different way and move beyond those basic functions to something more advanced. And this is when we got into artistic and scientific achievements. And I also think that God allows things and knowledge to develop and occur on a timeline. And that there are times when he pumps the brakes. We saw that happening in Babylon, when too much was happening too soon. And so he scattered people and gave them different languages. And now we sort of see those barriers being eradicated again, and we're starting to have a language. One other element of this is over time, Greek became the language of commerce. It became the language throughout these empires, which kind of overlay each other for the most part. And so there was, in a sense, a common language. There were the local languages. Christ spoke Aramaic. There were other dialects. There were other languages throughout the empire. Yet Greek was a common language. And so the New Testament was written in Greek, which may seem surprising, right? If we think about that, if Christ spoke Aramaic and Abraham spoke Hebrew, so the Old Testament was written in Hebrew, New Testament Greek, why wasn't the New Testament written in Hebrew? Well, because everyone would understand it in Greek. And when it was written, which was even after Christ's time, that was by far the universal language at the time, much the way English is today. So if you travel internationally, most have a pretty good education on English. And so it makes it easy for us to travel. At one point, that wasn't true. So in addition to the advancement of Greek, the Greek culture, many other religions were born during this time. Buddhism, Zoroastrianism, multiple gods were worshipped. And again, this was all initially very materialistic. It was very transactional. But as time went on, people had more time to think, and they started to ask questions beyond just the day-to-day, like, who are we? We refer to these now as the big questions of life. How did we get here? What is the soul? Where did it originate? Where does it go after this life? Where does it go? So they had time to think about this. Mystery religions started to be formed. And these are, in many ways, reinterpretations of early mysteries. And we're going to see that throughout history. And the Bible alludes to this, too. There's nothing really new. I think it was Thomas Jefferson or Thomas Edison. One of them said that originality is really an obfuscation of your sources. So if you can blur the source, then it appears original, but really it came from somewhere. And so these are in many ways reinterpretations of earlier mystery religions, but less materialistic and more about self-control, more about the development of the person, more about development of introspection and of knowledge and of wisdom, and less physical materialistic. There became the notion that man should control his inner passions to focus on spiritual development of the inner spirit. And this led to the beliefs that worship should be spiritual from the heart and an expression of the inner man. There also now was time to start to study outside of this universe and to observe cosmology. And while they were viewing at this time the sky, the stars, the constellations, that which was visible with the naked eye, so they didn't have telescopes yet, they didn't have the ability to do that, they noticed something. And this, again, is from their perspective, but they noticed that everything revolved around the earth. You can see how this might make sense, right? That all these things revolved around the earth, and they were able to see the earth, the moon, Mercury, Venus, the sun, the Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, and they observed that these operated sort of independently, and that there were seven layers. They started to see that there were seven layers. This is the way they interpreted things. And that Earth was home of the misery of the human experience. It was the most physical, basic, and less stellar of all of the different phases. And then it got progressively more amazing as one went out. And then the eighth sphere was beyond. That was that which did not revolve around the Earth. And the stars out there were stable and harmonious and immortal and orderly. And that they came up with a theory that man's origin and soul descends from the heavens to the earth, and the true rest is in the stars. So this will become significant when we start to see the justification behind worshiping on what day? What does most of the world worship on? Sunday. Is that worship of the sun? There's an answer, yes. And then there's an answer that it's more than that. It's bigger than that. And the answer that it's bigger than that is it's the eighth day. And the eighth day is significant to us. We also worship on the eighth day of the feast. And the eighth symbolizes something very significant, and that is it is a new beginning. So what we see is really a mixing and a counterfeit of truths. And we'll see that over and over and over again as a blending of truths and understanding of what truth might be. And they get close to it, but not quite. They don't quite understand it. It takes a full revealing of the truth through God's Holy Spirit to really understand it, to really be able to clearly see. And what we see here is that they didn't clearly see. And so this introduces a term for us, and that is sophists. So we know about philosophy. So think about that term soph, sophists. What other words might come from that root word sophist? Sophistication, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that one. And I have to think about how it applies. So sophists can be defined as based on clever but unsound reasoning. So sophistication may be a little more clever, a little more of bringing it together, a little more of an understanding. One is more sophisticated, has greater levels of understanding. I think that surely is. And Larry said sophomore. What is a sophomore? What does sophomoric mean? It sort of means that one thinks they understand more than they truly do, right? And that shows up in the second year of high school, second year of college, where one, after the freshman year where everything's new, the sophomore starts to feel like, I've really got this. I'm really more sophisticated than ever before. And that's referred to as sophomoric. The junior year tends to be the hardest year, where you start to realize you don't fully have it yet, but people now are expecting you to, and senior year it all comes together. But this clever but unsound reasoning describes this time period, perhaps, and we're going to go through the three different people that really had a large influence on this time period, and they were successive in terms of generation, and we'll start with Socrates. Now, at this point, I'm referring largely to the work of Gary Petty, who compiled this information, and this is actually the third chapter, where we're looking at Socrates, and he was part of a group referred to as sophists, and at this point, they were beyond the need to battle on a daily basis or on an annual basis. And so there were men that had time to think. And here's a depiction of perhaps Socrates on the left as he's reasoning with his students and the other men in society there. And so they started to become very prosperous, and prosperity gave way to philosophy. And they began to question the old ideas of absolute good and truth. There was this binary definition of good and bad. And they started questioning, well, where does that come from? What is good and what is bad? And asking questions. Virtue was defined as personal desires and feelings. So it became very subjective. And rejecting absolute standards. All religions were human interventions and constructs of humans to create fables to help them to feel good. I'll just ask, does any of this sound familiar? I mean, these are tenets of a political party, so to speak, that we're dealing with now. Very similar, almost verbatim. So, existence of God was debated. There was no truth. All views were subjective concepts of the individual, which include political views, religious beliefs, definitions of morality. There was still a generally accepted notion that by living a virtuous life, so not religious, but virtuous life, and doing good deeds, one could obtain happiness. Plato was a student of Socrates. He continued Socrates' thought process. In a sense, he stood on his shoulders, you might say. And where Socrates never wrote any of his thoughts down, he would ask questions, he would stimulate thought amongst his students. He had a way of teaching that was by the use of asking questions. And by asking questions, he would lead someone to the desired result. It's referred to today as the Socratic method, and a very effective method of teaching, actually, because it stimulates thought. So Plato was a student. He founded in Athens, one of the prominent Greek cities, a university called the Academy. And he started to develop these concepts a little bit more about the mind and matter. And in the mind was the soul, and what we might refer to as the spirit of man, that had levels of understanding that were beyond that of animals and were unique to man. And matter. So we've heard the term mind over matter. The origin was at this time period. And matter was copies of the ideals. So he did acknowledge that there was a creator, and he referred to it as the demiurge. That was the creator who created flawed and fallible human beings that were like copies are. We understand copy machines and how we put a copy of the original down, and maybe it's a picture, and when it comes out of the machine, it's a little grainy. It's not the same. It doesn't have the same resolution. It's not as good. And if you copy that again, then you keep repeating the process, and the quality goes down further. And that's the way Plato viewed humans and what was occurring in this world. But there's still a model of beauty and goodness and virtue. He understood the idea of daemons, daemons, that were like angels. And they could either be good or evil. So we start to see these facsimiles of the truth. that Plato was understanding here. He had this idea that each star is the home of one human soul created specifically for it. So each star was out there and would come and become a human and then aspire to get back to the perfection it once had. So he was a believer in reincarnation. One might go through several iterations necessary to get there and may go up and down a ladder in this life and ultimately aspire to get back to the original version. So a version of this religion dominated until the Roman Empire. So this became very prominent in Greek thought. Plato introduces the thought that the mind and the body should be developed. This was very prominent in Greek culture. So that all should be educated in the movements of the sun, the moon, and other planets. In this way, man would be able to comprehend the divine nature of the planets and stars and celebrate their ancient and traditional religious festivals. So now this is a sort of an insidious thought here. So what Plato said is that everyone should be educated, and with that education, they should come to the natural conclusions that this is the way things are. And then if they don't believe it or don't convert to it, then they must be executed. So we start to see that philosophy carry into some of the religious beliefs later. This interpretation shows up in the book of Daniel, which is about this same time. So we start to see some of these parallels at the same times. So most religions at this point were growing as well, and to keep up with the times, transformed from that materialistic past to a primary focus on the soul and the afterlife. Aristotle came after Plato and saw three categories: mathematics, physics, and metaphysics. So he, again, started to develop and iterate on these ideas. From him, we have deduction. Deduction that conclusions come from the universal to the particular. That's deduction, induction, the opposite from the particular to apply to the universal. All raisins are grapes, but not all grapes are raisins. That's my attempt at it. Putting that whole philosophy into a little concept. Stoicism. Stoicism is mentioned in the Bible. So this was founded in 301 BC, so near the end of the Greek Empire and into the beginning of the Roman Empire, which we'll see was sort of a transition, and we'll see what their unique contributions were. And this is taking it another notch forward, where Zeno felt like the human should not be affected by passion and should be able to completely repress feeling, manifesting or maintaining an austere indifference to joy, grief, pleasure, or pain. So the Stoics felt that all material things are a mixture of fire, air, water, and earth, and that God transcends all matter, and that if we can deny the self, we can become more like God or more in tune with Him. They adopted this astrology theology as well, and we'll talk a little bit more about that, and the eighth layer. So the eighth day might have become a day of worship during this time. Another one of these strains of thought that is mentioned also in the Bible is Epicureanism. Epicureanism, I'm going to ask you to tune your ears and let me know if you think any of this sounds familiar as well. Some of the key tenets of Epicureanism were to seek happiness as the goal of life. Anything that makes a person happy is to be considered good, and if something doesn't make one happy, then it should be avoided. Gods have little relevance in this world, in this philosophy. Physical happiness, sensations, and attractions are the goal of life. Does that sound familiar in any way? Go to the local bookstore. There are sections dedicated to this ideology. Today, you can read New York Times bestsellers on this philosophy. Astral fatalism shows up, and you'll start to recognize this as well. This construct was developed during this time period. Your birth date determines the spiritual and cosmic forces that shape your personality and affect events throughout your life. Where do we read about this? How do we know about this? Where does this show up? Astrology and your horoscope, right? You go to read your horoscope. And why would this be true? Because if your soul came from a star out there, and if it came in the month of April, then it had to come through these stars that were all in alignment at this time, and they have an impact on your life. And so you can go to read what would happen to you because of what were happening with the stars at the time and the impact that that has. Now, there's a little flaw with this theory, and that is not everything is happening to the people that were all born in April at the same time. And so it's fun, but people still rush to read their horoscope daily. They used to rush to the paper. It was in the newspaper. Go to that page and read what was going to happen to them. Now, you may have an app for that, but this still shows up today. So many of these cults were mystery cults. This is also important because this shows up as well. Passed on by oral tradition and were the private revelation of the truth obtained by mystical processes to a select group of people. One trick of Satan is to mix falsehood with truth and to desensitivize people by presenting something that is false to them so that when they hear the truth, it's categorized as false. So, here's where this might show up. So, if something is secret or private, can only be known by a few and has to be passed on in a certain way, then that sounds ridiculous, does it not? Well, then what is the truth? Well, the truth is that one must, biblical truth is, the truth that Christ practiced and that was taught was that one must undergo baptism, come up and ask, and a prayer is prayed to ask for the Holy Spirit to give them guidance and direction and help them understand things that they wouldn't have understood before. That's what we read in the truth. But if these constructs were proven false at some point, then that also sounds false, does it not? Can you see how we can see Satan's influence here, and he continues to do it. Just like we have difficult scriptures, others study those same difficult scriptures and refute the true interpretation of them. It's very complex. Okay. So one difference, though, is that Christianity later became open to all. Even the Jews had a hard time with that. Like, wait a minute. We're the special God's chosen people. It's through DNA, it's through the family tree. We know all the way back to Abraham where we came from. And that they said this. These are biblical passages, right? But now what was being taught later in Christianity is this truth is open to everyone. Well, you can see that all of them had a little bit of a problem with that. So back to Greek culture. Greeks sought less to conquer than to influence. Until Alexander the Great, for he was right at the end of the Grecian Empire. Before that, though, the Greeks would go and they would set up and they would share their philosophies and educate people, and it was more or less peaceful. They just spread their ideology and spread their thoughts, and that's how Greek culture spread. There was a city-state approach. And so rather than be unified in an empire manner the way the Romans were, then if you would have asked someone from Greek who they were and what they were at the time, they might have said, we are from Athens, we are Athenians, or we are Thessalonians, or we are Corinthians, or we are Spartans. Like we may say, we are Phoenicians, or we have some from San Diego, or Michigan, and what do we say? There is a term. Michiganders. Is it Michiganders? Yes! Michiganders. And they think that we ride camels out here. Right? But no, we're Arizonans or Phoenicians or whatever it is. So more Phoenicians, right? Michigan is the state. They saw themselves as citizens of a city-state. And so all of them would go and be educated and learn and work their farms. And then in the spring season, they may have to get together and send the men out to fight. And so they would do that. And sometimes it would be against others, or sometimes it would be against each other. But until Alexander came along, they had relative peace. And then he united them all into a standing army. They did have contests between towns. We have teams, right? We have, what's that basketball team from L.A.? I forget. Yeah, whatever. Don't say that in church. We have the Suns here, right? That we know. And then all those other guys, right? Don't say it, John. Ralph. I can see both of you. We don't want to talk about those dirty words, but that's the way they were too. And then the Spartans decided that they were just going to conquer everyone, and war became a way of life for them. And at 12 years old, mothers would come and give their sons over to the army, basically, where they would be trained, and they would conquer everyone. And so then they ultimately wrapped this all up. And so this led to a more powerful and influential Greece. We see that as time goes on. Alexandria, Egypt, became part of the Grecian Empire. As we see, it swept through Israel and the Middle East and into the north part of Africa. And Alexandria actually became the cultural capital of the world. There was a library in Alexandria that tried to capture all books in all languages and all knowledge at the time. And so to go to Alexandria to study was like the ultimate in sophistication. It would be likened to going to Harvard or pick it, MIT, or depending on the MIT for technology, Harvard maybe for law, Wharton maybe for business. Pick your favorite school and what they're famous for. Others for engineering. Alexandria was like the ultimate. And so we see Alexandria play a big role. Cleopatra ruled Alexandria, and she developed a relationship with Julius Caesar and later with Mark Antony. And Mark Antony and Cleopatra in this naval battle fought against the Roman Empire and Julius Caesar. And when they fell, then Rome started to dominate. And we know that Rome became the capital, and so while we don't know specifically what happened, we know that Julius Caesar happened to be in Alexandria when that library burned. And so a lot of that knowledge, that compilation, was lost because it was burned. So this 300-year time period, with the few minutes we have that are remaining, I'm going to introduce some terms to you that might help us as we continue to build on this foundation. Hellenistic. Have you heard the term Hellenistic? Hellenistic comes from these Greek ideas, and it's really sort of a blending. Hellas means Greek, Hellen means man. So it's these thoughts of Greek men, and Hellenists were Greek intellectuals. So the intelligentsia was ruling at the time, and we also do see that in society today here. And so this Hellenistic period was from the death of Alexander the Great to 31 BC. So it clearly overlaps these biblical times. And it's this blending, the way it's referred to in the Bible, it's this blending of these powerful Greek ideas with Judaism. I left you with the thought last time, and I'll refer back to this today. This was the observation of Horace at the time. Captive Greece took Rome captive. So Rome came and conquered Greece, ultimately, and that naval battle was the culmination of that. But the ideology took Rome captive. So this Hellenistic period, from the time that Rome, 320s, or actually from Cleopatra on, these Grecian ideas were very popular. And they throughout the whole Roman Empire, which included the area of Judaism or Jerusalem, and all the area that was the property of the tribes of Israel as well. So initially, this contrasted with what was given by God, and then it started to blend, and it started to become very appealing. And so we're introducing a term now, that of syncretism. Syncretism is a blend of Egyptian, Asian, Babylonian, Egyptian, Greek, and Syrian pagan religions, from astrology and from Judaism, and then later Christianity, all blended together. And what we read about now, what we see evident now, is really the result of these syncretistic views. Pagan. Does anybody know what pagan means? It's sort of an antonym for sophisticated. It meant rustic. So it was viewed as rustic or unsophisticated, rural. So I think what we're seeing is that every civilization, every grouping of humans, when we say man, we really mean humans, understands and recognizes a need to attach to God. There's something created in us, part of the spirit of man, that causes us to look for meaning beyond just this. And when we properly understand God's truths and have access to the Holy Spirit, then that is filled, and we see the formula in Romans 8. Spirit of man plus the Spirit of God equals children of God. Yet without that, there's still this desire to understand in some way, and so fabrications occur to fill it in. And we see that there are rustic tribes that have some idea of what they worship. Some worship the animals, some form of creation rather than the creator, because they lacked understanding of the creator. And so the term pagan defines that rural or rustic. It's sort of a derogatory term for polytheism and a blending of all these different ideas. It's been used by Christians to apply to others. So others, another word for others, is Gentiles. And who used the term Gentile? Where does that show up? Shows up in the New Testament, and shows up from the Jews. We say Jews, but it's not just the Jews. The other tribes of Israel, sons of Abraham, would refer to others that were not of the tribes as Gentiles because they didn't have the same genes. They were of other genes. So now we start to understand what pagan means and what Gentile means. And then it was a clear delineation that there were Jews and Greeks. We read about that, right? Neither Jew nor Greek. Male nor female. Slave nor free. These differences. So Jews or Greeks or Hellenists or Gentiles, which were even broader, would be referred to in that way. And then this is also somewhat provocative and inflammatory. If pagan isn't enough, then we go to heathen. Heathen does not sound like it has a positive tone to it, does it? And heathens were not Christians. So that was even broader. Even Jews and Gentiles could agree that they were heathens. So we see this, and we're going to come and pick it up next time and start to look into the scriptures. And I'll plant a couple of seeds here. You can look at 1 Corinthians 1 and verse 18, where we start to see some of these ideas being addressed. So Paul is writing to Corinth at this time, and he's saying, many of you say the message of the cross is foolishness, and the wisdom of this world rejects God. But he's saying God makes that wisdom foolishness. So we're going to start to see now, after now we've laid the foundation and see where a lot of these ideas are coming from, we're going to see scriptural application of where they're being contested in the Bible. So we'll pick it up next time with coexistence and this uneasy coexistence. And we'll finish by summarizing Greeks and their contribution to the world. Were they, and this is from their perspective, were discoverers of universal truth. The Romans adopted many of these Greek philosophies, but they were purveyors of a superior civilization. And that's when we're starting to really see the effects of Rhodes and the effects of their military. And then the Jews, which are referred to as Jews because, again, the tribe of Judah was the most recognizable, but we understand a broader application there. These were exclusive people of God's covenant and the Torah, the interpretation of this law and this covenant. They were builders. This is their perspective. Others didn't respect this always, but builders and caretakers of God's only temple. They were recipients of the land of Israel by divine right. And it was necessary to create a religiously pure Israel so that the anointed king would be sent by the Lord Almighty to rule all nations. And they were looking forward to that ruler, that Messiah, to come back at that time. So next we'll head into the time period of the New Testament. And we'll start to get into Christianity and the context that Christ was born into and how that affected his life. And hopefully we're putting all of these time periods and these ideas into order and on the timeline, and we'll build a structure that we can attach more to. So we'll look forward to next time.